This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan. You've probably seen pictures of the demonstrations going on in Cuba, which kind of shocked me because I thought the demonstrations were illegal. But let's consult with Stephen Murphy, who is a senior advisor for Latin America for Pacific Northwest Advisors and has written a couple of books, including Havana Odyssey and On the Edge, and is pretty familiar with Cuba. What precipitated these demonstrations, Stephen?
I think it was an accumulation of shortages this year when they floated the Cuban peso, as I predicted in my book, actually, last year. That set off a spiral of inflation and a scarcity of goods. The state stores ran out of the staples that most Cubans relied on, and so they had to kind of deal on the black market, and most Cubans don't have dollars to pay for foodstuffs. And unless you have a small farm in the interior like our associate Jorge does, it's pretty hard to get by. Coupling that with the lack of vaccine to combat the COVID virus, and that was a tinderbox. And I think they just had enough, particularly since the rollout on the vaccine has been very, very slow. There are mostly younger people that have just, been under the regime of scarcity since they were born. And I think they just had enough after all of these years. That there's also that song that I sent you called Homeland and Life, which is a play on Fidel's words, which in Spanish was homeland and death. That just kind of epitomizes, I think, what people believe. It's a very visceral.
Yeah, I'll play a snippet of this. It is a pretty visceral and an angry song, and some of the quotes: "We are the dignity of an entire people trampled. No more lies, my people demand freedom. The deceit is over." So, is this a rejection of the entire communist system?
I think a lot of it just has to do with hopelessness. They announce all these measures, but nothing happens. They don't really give the small business person opportunity, and that's the person that does the hair salon or the tourist guide or the translator. And without food and without vaccine and kind of an endless summer of heat, it creates a lot of despair.
Well, now the Cuban government blames our embargo.
Well, that's been certainly the revolutionary excuse for 60-some years, and it certainly does have an impact. But when I went to Cuba the several times, I could find all the U.S. products that were theoretically banned, like Coca-Cola that came from Mexico or medicine that came from Germany under Pfizer's mark. I think the Cubans, and as the Biden administration said, they have to – their rulers have to listen to the Cuban people and see what their needs are and not just blame the United States, which they've been doing for 60-some years.
Yeah. When I was there in 2013, I was trying to figure out how they organize these demonstrations, because when I was there in 2013, there was no internet. I mean, so how are they even organizing these things?
Well, thanks to the Chinese, they have now Wi-Fi in most public squares throughout Cuba. Huawei got the contract, and as mentioned in, I think it was chapter 33 of my book, this was the Pandora's box that I think opened it up, because now people can access that. So this was organized basically via WhatsApp. When I communicate to Cuba, WhatsApp is the medium of choice, and that's how the Cuban youth communicated to each other in Cuba.
Didn't they anticipate this might happen?
I guess they thought the youth needed an escape valve, but when you don't have food, you don't have medicine, and you don't have hope, then it's a tinderbox of uprising. I think the government has to decide whether it's really going to have a more open market-oriented economy and not just have it kind of officially out there, but in practice not. except for the 10% at the top, the apparatchik, the Castro family, and those that are friends. And then there's about 20% of the people that might have a farm in the interior or money coming in from Cuban Americans stateside or from Spain. But if you're not in that 10 or 20%, it's a real hard life. And I think that's kind of the gasoline that is kind of spreading slowly through the island.
I'm surprised they had a vaccination problem, because I know they're very proud of their system of medical clinics and how everybody has access to health care. Why couldn't they get the population vaccinated?
Because they didn't have the money for the Chinese or the Russian vaccines. And despite their being so-called socialist brothers, China and Russia accept hard currency and not the Cuban peso.
Yeah.
And so they've had to develop their own in-house vaccine that hasn't been peer-reviewed, that they've started vaccinating maybe about 10, 15% of the population with this kind of untested vaccine. And it's just it's accumulation of the effects of kind of this top-down economy that doesn't provide a necessary revenue to get hard currency abroad so they can import medicine and vaccine as well.
Could this be the thing then that finally tips the balance and they move towards more of a, you know, Chinese police state capitalism model as opposed to just outright socialism?
Well, I think the Biden administration is saying the right things. They're not caving in and saying, well, I'll just get rid of the embargo overnight, but they're saying, no, let's have you talk to the Cuban people, to the artists, the dissidents. And I think there really has to be action on the part of the apparatchik president, Diaz-Canel, who's the current president that was nominated by Raul Castro.
So it'll have to start at the top. By the way, do you have any insight into what the heck happened in Haiti?
You know, my sources say that there are people that were unhappy that the deceased president overstayed his term of office. But as we know, throughout the world, people like to stay on whether they're reelected or not.
Stephen Murphy is the author of Havana Odyssey, Chasing Ochoa's Ghost, and he's a Latin America specialist for Pacific Northwest Advisors. Stephen, thanks very much.
No, de qué. Gracias, Dave. Bye-bye. Hey,
oh, choke points.
Let's go.
Revive I-5 is back. That means some lanes will close this weekend. And we also have news of a couple of new lanes which will now suddenly spring into existence. But let's start with the closings first. Chris, what's happening?
Well, the paving and expansion joint repair between I-90 and Spokane Street, which is lovingly referred to as Revive I-5, is back this weekend. So there are going to be some southbound I-5 lane reductions beginning Friday night, lasting through Monday morning. The Washington State Department of Transportation's Tom Pierce says these closures will be different than the first time full closure a few weeks ago.
Friday night, we're going to reduce southbound I-5 to two lanes, and then that's going to be the configuration through Saturday. And then on Sunday, we're going to take it down to a single lane.
But drivers will remain on the freeway. You won't be forced to exit. During the first closure, you might remember, all the traffic had to exit at I-90 when they shut down the freeway, and then they used the collector-distributor lanes to get back to I-5. Well, this time, the collector-distributor lanes will not go all the way through to I-5.
People will be able to go into the collector-distributor. They'll be able to get off for I-90, Dearborn, 4th Avenue South, Airport Way. They just won't be able to continue on through.
This also means that the east and westbound I-90 drivers will not be able to access southbound I-5. Those ramps are going to be closed, too, because they, of course, empty right into the CD lane. WashDOT's Pierce says the first full closure resulted in 4-plus miles of backups. He expects heavy congestion again.
Having the second lane on Saturday is going to make things better, but we don't want people to get lulled into a false sense of security. And then Sunday we hit and we're down to a single lane. That could make things really rough if people are not prepared, if people are not planning to do other things.
405, 99 remain the primary alternates during this closure. Now, there is a chance that this work could be postponed if the weather gets wet. We heard Nick Allard earlier this hour say we might get a couple of sprinkles towards the end of the week. Maybe not enough to postpone this, but we will definitely keep you up to date.
And now to the new lanes that are going to appear. Where are those?
All right. We got one here in the Seattle area and then one a little bit further south. I'm going to start with the new northbound HOV lane between DuPont and New Lakewood. That has now opened. That's all part of this JBLM project there. So that gives HOV drivers another 4.5 miles of lane to use. The southbound HOV lane in that same stretch of road is supposed to open in August. Now, eastbound I-90 drivers have a new auxiliary lane between Eastgate and Lakemont. Remember, they've been working on that for the last year or so, maybe 2 years. This is a nearly 2 mile lane built on the right shoulder that basically connects the two ramps there between Eastgate and, you know, Westlake Sammamish Parkway. It provides a lot more room to merge between the exits, which should cut down on the congestion. The westbound auxiliary lane is still under construction and it should open in the fall, but we've got a little bit more pavement to use, and any little bit helps.
Yeah. I've been wondering what that project was. That has been going on for a long time. So
Yeah, it has.
Is the bike lane part of that too?
Well, the like what you saw in Factoria, certainly, because they built that ramp so you don't interact with the cars there on the trail getting off at Factoria. So that's all kind of part of this whole thing. But what they did is they built up the shoulder for the freeway. No bikes on the freeway, but they they did connect part of the trail there, at least through Factoria.
Okay, and last month you were talking about this the Good to Go website outage. How did that go?
Yeah. Went well. A matter of fact, first of all, they postponed it by a couple of weeks while you were on vacation because they had a software glitch. And so instead of happening in the middle of June, it actually was pushed to just a couple of, the last 10 days. It was supposed to be down until Friday, but they opened it up yesterday ahead of schedule. But the thing is with that is that we've got a new website. The call center is back up. If you're a Good to Go user, and there are 2 million of us out there in the state, you need to log on to the new website because you're going to have to change your password. So that's something that you need to do. But after that, you can opt into some really cool new features there that are now on the web, like being able to pay as you go as opposed to holding a balance. You'll be able to change a lot of your information there via the website, because the old website you could was not user-friendly at all. It was too old. And so that has been fixed, and it's up and running, 4 days ahead of schedule.
So everybody's got to log on and change their password now?
Yeah, they do.
All
2 million. We have to go in there and kind of set things up, make sure everything's cool, log into the system, and then hopefully that won't crash it. So not everybody go out there right now and log in.
Right. But that's only if you have some business there. I mean, if I, like, forget, as I tend to do when it comes to updating passwords on websites, I'm still going to get my bill normally. I'm not going to be charged with evading the toll or anything, right?
Oh, no. You'll still be fine. It's just, it changes your options. I mean, there's some things, if you log in, they want you to get in there and kind of explore what the new website has to offer for you, which offers you a lot more.
Are there cool TikTok videos I can watch?
Yeah, Matt, well, there are videos. They put them up at mynorthwest.com last week, two weeks ago, on what you can expect, what you can do for things like opting into text message alerts, things like that, or being able to I like the idea of not having to carry a balance. You know, before you had to put that $30 on there, now you can just pay as you go. You have just the credit card on there.
I can get alerts. It can tell me you just crossed the 520 bridge.
I haven't watched that particular video to let me know exactly whether or not it's that user friendly, but I'm thinking if you're crossing the 520 bridge, you should know that
already. You should know that, but sometimes.
But yeah, at some point this week, go in to log into your account, you refresh your password and check it out, but it's up and running.
There is at least some relief for the family of a 19-year-old who was gunned down in the CHOP zone, as the suspect is finally under arrest. Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah.
The so-called CHOP zone had become an area where tourists from out of state and even out of the nation had come to visit and see what Mayor Durkin at one point described as a summer of love. Then in the early morning hours of June 20th, 2020... things turned violent, as investigators say. Then 18-year-old Marcel Long opened fire after chasing down 19-year-old Lorenzo Anderson because of an ongoing feud the two had from a fight a year before. The scene that night, chaotic. There were no police in the East Precinct, and things had grown tense between police and those inside the CHOP zone. Fire medics sat just outside as Lorenzo Anderson lay bleeding, not ready to come in unless they had police protection. In the end, CHOP medics rushed Lorenzo Anderson to the hospital, where he later died. And when police showed up...
Please move out of the way so we can get to the victim. All we're trying to do is get to the victim and provide them aid.
Confusion as they thought they were trying to get to the victim, who had already been rushed to the hospital. Converge Media's Amari Salisbury was there on scene for the entire thing.
So it very well could be the Seattle police mustered their forces outside of the zone until they had the appropriate manpower to come into the zone. I don't know, but now you got another situation because you got the police who are now not necessarily surrounded, but there's a lot of people out here.
That shooting suspect, Marcel Long, immediately left the state, according to those who knew him. The King County prosecutor issued an arrest warrant. And he had been on the run since then until yesterday.
There has been an arrest in the Lorenzo Anderson case. U.S. Marshals, along with SPD detectives, responded to a location in Des Moines, Washington, where the suspect was located and verified and taken into custody.
That's SPD Sergeant Randy Huesrich, who says there had been word that Long had left the state, possibly even the country, but they were able to find him right close to home in Des Moines.
Obviously, that's where we found him, what his whereabouts has been over the last, little more than a year at this point. Detectives will be looking into all of that, but he was arrested here just in the Seattle suburbs.
And it was a big arrest for SPD.
This was one of the homicides that did indeed occur at the CHOP, and we will certainly continue to work with U.S. Marshals as well as other law enforcement agencies around the area to address any other potential cases that may or may not have been related to this specific shooting and then any incidents that extended from there.
Just about a month ago, on the year anniversary of when Lorenzo Anderson was shot and killed, his mother had pleaded for Marcel Long to turn himself in. His father, Horace Anderson, who I spoke to about a month ago, also frustrated then that there had been no justice for his son.
Unbelievable. It's very heartbreaking. I've been in counseling. It's been almost a year, so the days are kind of coming back together again because it's almost about to be a year when it's happening. And it's like, we still hasn't nobody stepped up to be accountable for the actions of what happened.
On hearing the news of the fact that Marcel Long has been arrested, dad's attorney says there is some relief for his dad about that arrest, but there's more to it.
He's happy. He's grateful for law enforcement's efforts and all involved in bringing the suspect in. However, Lorenzo could have been saved, and he should have been saved, and he was essentially left to die.
Dad's attorney Evan Oshun says they've got plans for legal filings.
Actively pursuing a civil action against the city, the state, the county of King, as well as the mayor, Mayor Jenny Durkin, and others who were involved in this CHOP zone fiasco.
That should be coming very, very soon. We've also got a lawsuit that's separate that was filed against the city of Seattle by Lorenzo Anderson's mother.
And is there any indication that the suspect chose to have this play out in the CHOP because of the lawlessness in the area?
Not that I'm aware of. I've been told different things about how it was that Lorenzo Anderson ended up there. He wasn't somebody who was normally at the CHOP. I think mm-hmm. he had just gone and kind of checked it out. But the legal filings are basically, they're not about anything like what you've just suggested, that they went there mm-hmm. for that reason. It's largely about the fact that there was many, many minutes. It was almost 20 minutes that the kid was shot and laying there before finally the CHOP mm-hmm. medics rushed him to the hospital because the medics wouldn't come in. And just the overall, I think, lawlessness of that area and the lack of public safety that was provided there because of that while the East Precinct was abandoned.
Right. Hannah Scott. Hannah, thanks very much.
You bet.
Daily Dose of Kind is brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Inspired after creating Halloween masks with his kids, a California artist set out to transform prosthetics for children into superhero armor, changing the lives of his young customers. CBS's Jamie Yukas reports.
Oil and water may not mix, but paint and water do. It's called hydro dipping, and Ricardo Murrow is an artist.
Hydro dipping is a water transfer print, so basically painting in water.
After creating Halloween masks for his own kids, he was inspired to help others.
I was thinking, like, well, if this brought happiness to a kid wearing a mask, imagine a kid with a prosthetic.
The first was 4 years ago.
It literally made him, like, run across the room like he was a superhero. And he was smiling and he was so happy. And so it was something that I felt changed his life.
Since then, Murrow has brought joy to many kids. Wow. And he does it all for free. 13-year-old Abraham Cisneros lost both legs last year after an infection. A double gift from Murrow came with a revelation.
I like wearing shorts better pants.
I think he likes to show them off because of the prints. He feels more like, hey, look at my prosthetics, you know, they're superhero. You're doing so good.
You must put a lot of love into those pieces.
Definitely. I want to give chances to kids to let them see that there is still good in this world.
Hey, Rick.
What's up, buddy?
I like my legs.
I'm happy, man.
Changing the life of a child, a superpower indeed. Jamie Yukis, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Changing lives one superpower at a time. How cool.
That's right. And now, guest hosting on the G and Ursula show, which starts at 9, is Aaron Mason.
Dave
when
Ross.
When was the last time I talked to you? Was that a radio drama somewhere?
Yeah, on stage at Town Hall, I believe.
That was it.
Yeah.
Well, it's
you?
Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, too.
Even in miniature form.
Yeah, this Microsoft Teams, I get a view of this beard I've heard so much about.
Do you think?
It truly is glorious.
You should have seen the untrimmed version, my friend.
I've heard.
Out of control, filled the whole screen. So, look, you strike me as a tech-savvy millennial type.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about all the new things that Amazon's trying to do with its smart speakers, the latest being this sleep monitoring radar technology?
Yeah, it's odd. I'll say first, I'm not a huge fan. I don't have any device in my house, anything that's listening to me outside of the phone I carry in my pocket, which you might say defeats the purpose because it's with me everywhere.
Yes.
But no, I generally don't like that kind of thing. Cameras make me even more nervous. And the idea now that I think the goal is good. They're trying to figure out a way to monitor your sleep so you get better sleep, more restful sleep, healthy sleep hygiene, as they call it. Fine, but I don't like Amazon having a 3D map of my home and knowing every little move I make while I'm not even conscious. That just feels very creepy to me, Dave.
So you think it's a privacy invasion? But I mean, this has been going around for a long time that Amazon wants to know everything about you. But
yeah.
Physically, as big as that company is, there's no way that there's somebody all the time looking at the layout of your bedroom. They don't care about that.
Right. No, I'm not that important or interesting. Yeah, that is
exactly.
That is absolutely.
Now, the NSA, true. That may be something different, but I don't think that Bezos and company really care about your bedroom. They're looking for something that will keep you loyal, and eventually probably they want to get a monthly subscription fee out of you somewhere.
Right.
Along.
That's the thing. Dang it, Dave. It's the principle of the thing. And I just feel like asleep in my bed in my bedroom is somewhere that no one else needs to know about. is it fair to put that size restriction? Just my bedroom,
I guess,
please?
So, yes.
I don't know, so. but I am curious about the idea of improving sleep, because as you mentioned, we don't talk often because I'm usually here when you're not. And I know how jarring it can be to shift what I would consider quote unquote normal schedule to to the one that you guys do here every day. How do you manage that? I mean, if this is something that could help improve, mm-hmm. you know, my situation there, I might be a little more inclined to engage with it. Maybe.
Well, here's the secret. It's highly technical and it takes a lot of discipline, but the key is to go to bed early.
It can't be simple.
No, it is literally that simple. And it what it means is sometimes you have to go to bed way early, and which is especially difficult in the summer because the sun is still up.
Mm-hmm, right.
So if I was following my ideal schedule, I'd be in bed by 8:30. Now, being in bed and being asleep, sometimes two different things.
Right.
Last night, I got involved in a very heated game of solitaire on the computer. I did not get to bed until after 10 o'clock.
Your nemesis.
Which is why I've sounded groggy all morning. But that's really the key, Aaron. So, and you don't need any kind of high-tech device to tell you that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. It is difficult when it's still light out. Do you have blackout curtains? Do you wear an eye mask?
Do you tie a shirt
around your head like I do?
I have one of those sleep machines, right? But I use it as scuba gear. So you can just pull the covers over your head and you're still able to breathe. It works perfectly. I don't know if the machine was intended for that, but that's how I use it.
It's like the reed in the water in cartoons.
The only way my wife knows that I'm even home is that the quilt rises and falls slightly.
I love that.
I'm always happy to help whenever I can. So have a good time with Ursula.
Yeah, thanks. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
She really hates hearing people disagree with her, but good luck anyway.
I'm ready. I'm ready to go.
Disappointing news for supporters of ranked choice voting in King County. With that report, let's go to KYRadio's Hannah Scott.
Yeah, Dave, it was just 24 hours ago, right, that we were talking about how the King County Council had advanced a measure that would have put on this November's ballot a charter amendment basically asking voters if they wanted to shift away from our traditional election model to ranked choice voting, which is, again, where you pick your candidates, you eliminate the primary and you pick your candidates, just ranking them in the order of your preference. And then there are various rounds to knock off the guys on the bottom. And then whoever's left is the last man standing wins, or last person standing, I should say. At any rate, that was moving right along. There were a lot of people who came out in support of that and spoke at last week's meeting. They were supposed to vote on it today. But there was some concerns last week at the meeting as well.
Particularly the rushed nature of this, the open questions, and the elimination of the primary. I'd like to have more dialogue and more specificity, particularly on an issue of this magnitude. So it's very regrettable to me that we would rush this on this schedule. This has some promise and I'm interested in it, but not on this kind of approach.
Yeah, this is coming pretty fast. We've done a ton of work at the county level in improving our system of elections.
It's a frustrating issue because the arguments have been extremely well outlined by the proponents. I just want more time. I feel very strongly that we need some more input and more discussion and hopefully a lot more work.
Now, of course, the arguments in favor of this include things like, one, makes people think that they have a voice, that their vote actually counts, that it would take some of the ugliness out of our elections process, and a variety of other reasons. It looked like that was still going to hold, even though three council members did vote against that last week. But then the sponsor, Guillermo Zahalai, tweeted out yesterday they are actually going to postpone the ranked choice voting legislation and continue to work on it until next year's ballot. There's a lot of support, as you could even hear. Some of those people who spoke were council members who actually voted for it. They just expressed concern. So there's a lot of support, just the desire to do more work on it. So next year's ballot is the idea now.
I see. Well, okay. You would think in an off-year election, though, would be a little easier to swallow, right, than if you do it. Or because would that then apply to federal elections or just local?
No, this is just for the King County election. So this would be your county prosecutor, county council, assessor, things like that would have been the idea. And I think that the issue was, look, Guillermo Zahalai had proposed this. I think it was just 3 weeks ago. They'd had one hearing on it, which was great. But there was a lot of unanswered questions and some concerns that some of the council members wanted to have vetted that they simply weren't going to have the opportunity to do because of the deadlines required to get it on the November ballot.
Does this have to do all with Dow Constantine having a serious challenger for the first time in a long time in the upcoming election?
I don't think so, because this would not have applied to this election, right? So Dow's on the ballot this year. This would have been the question of whether or not to switch to this kind of method would have been on the ballot this year, but not the actual elections of various candidates yet.
Okay. KYRadio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Tuesday mornings, we go live to Washington, D.C., and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at The Washington Post, who also happens to be our chief Texas consultant on account of he comes from there. And the legislature, the Democrats anyway, have fled again to deny a quorum to the Texas legislature, which is trying take two on this effort to revise and enhance voting security. Do I have that right?
That's the Republican take on it, yes.
Okay. So what the bill has changed, right? This bill deleted a couple of the provisions that Democrats found most odious, right?
That's right. It is there had previously been a method, a way of taking reducing the sort of quote unquote souls to the polls hours used by often by black churches on Sundays. Before they had banned voting until like later in the afternoon on Sundays. That's gone. And there was also a provision that made it easier to basically overturn an election if there was allegations of fraud. That's also gone.
Okay, that was the creepiest part, the overturning part. Could you remind us what that would have involved?
I think in the past you needed to be able to prove that there had been enough, if the votes had been counted correctly, the election would have gone the other way. And as I recall, that they had diluted that standard such that you only had to prove that there were, you know, enough votes in question without showing how they would have voted. I think it still would have been hard to overturn an election, but any move in the direction of allowing a judge to overturn an election without the highest level of proof is kind of scary.
Okay, so that would have been something that would have been a court procedure then to where a judge would be empowered to throw out the results?
That's right. It was changing the standard of evidence that a judge might need to throw out the results in order a new election.
Okay, now what about this idea of the legislature itself overturning an election?
Well, I mean, the legislature's, you know, if you believe that interpretation of the Constitution, that every legislature, you know, has the right to challenge election results from its own state, in the case of presidential elections, it changed the way its electors voted. It didn't matter in Texas this time because Texas was Republican. I don't know if this has changed that or not. I think in the end, the impact of this particular bill, even if it passed, would not be huge in Texas. I've been seeing people say, like, the bigger threat for Democrats in Texas is redistricting, which may, you know, Democrats have benefited as more people have moved to Texas from other states. But because they don't have control of the state, their greater numbers may give Republicans more leeway to gerrymander some new Republican seats.
Huh. Well, then if this is not that threatening, why have Democrats decided to go to the wall on this?
Well, two reasons. I think, A, there's nothing really for them to lose. You know, they don't, you know, there's no loss of, you know, they have no power anyway in Texas. The Republicans and the legislature have sort of run roughshod over them for years, and especially recently. That was the case in the session that happened in the spring. There was even less consideration of Democratic ideas and priorities than usual. And I think they've decided, well, you know, it's not like there's any goodwill that we're going to lose. The goodwill's all gone anyway. They also may see this as a negotiating tactic, that if the longer they stay gone, the more they're able to get some changes made in that bill in return for coming back to the state.
Is their real agenda perhaps to get Congress to pass some regulation of redistricting, since that is the main threat?
I know they would like that. But, you know, if they're coming to Washington hoping that that's going to happen, I think they may be disappointed. There's a lot of things, big things that are kind of under discussion in Washington, but of all of those, I think that is one of the furthest from passing.
Okay, let's get to your beat, which, of course, has been Donald Trump. You have relentlessly tried to put a microscope to his finances. The your latest piece on the Trump Organization is about Alan Weisselberg, and he's resigned. So what was the point of that?
Well, he is the CFO of the Trump Organization, I believe, still. He certainly was the CFO of the Trump Organization as of two weeks ago when he was indicted for tax fraud. So the Trump Organization has a million little LLCs and corporations that run its individual properties. And that's how it's administered, through this sort of web of LLCs. And they've begun removing Weisselberg's name from individual LLCs, you know, the LLC that runs Trump Doral or that runs the Trump Hotel in Washington. They haven't, as far as I can tell, actually kicked him out of his job as CFO of the whole organization. So these changes for now are kind of more a formality. Like it may have posed problems for those individual LLCs to get loans or deal with regulators if they had an indicted guy on their board of directors. I mean, if they get rid of Weisselberg from the company, the Trump Organization itself, that to me is more significant. Or if he leaves on his own accord. Remember, Weisselberg is the key witness that prosecutors want to turn against Donald Trump. Yeah. And so we're alive for any sign that Weisselberg has turned or that Trump is alienating him by kicking him out, you know, at just the time when he needs him to be close to him.
But you know, there is no indication, though, that he has, in fact, turned state's evidence.
No, and we are asking all the time. And it, as far as we can tell, this seems to have been something the Trump Organization did basically to reduce hassles from its lenders and vendors and regulators rather than, you know, any indication of something that Weisselberg did.
Yeah. Now, I know this is somewhat off your beat, but is it pretty clear that the Trump Donald Trump is planning to run again?
I mean, he hasn't announced it, but I think it's pretty clear that he is planning that. I mean, I think we should all assume that he's going to until he says otherwise. You know, I don't see the downside for him and allows him to raise money.
Right. And does anything that's going to happen in court change that?
I don't think so. I mean, to me, the consequences of this court proceeding in New York will be for Alan Weisselberg, maybe for Trump if they indict him. I think that's kind of a ways off. It's if that's ever going to happen. The biggest consequences will be on the company. Remember, the Trump Organization is already like, it's running on one cylinder and two wheels. You know, it's really, you've got a lot of problems. And if the loss of Weisselberg, the extra legal fees, the legal pressure, that could cause the Trump Organization to fail as a company or sort of roll up and leave. I don't think it will hurt Trump as a politician or, you know, change his mind about running in 2024.
Yeah. Now, in terms of what he's doing now to affect the party and the candidates it chooses, does he in fact take a role in that? Does he have I know he's always fundraising.
He's always fundraising.
How much does he have at his disposal at this point?
Well, he's fundraising for himself, and I think a little bit for the Republican Party too. He's doing a fundraiser at his golf course in New York for the New York Republican Party on Wednesday, tomorrow. But you know, he does take a role in endorsing candidates. But people observing those congressional races have said that he seems to be picking based only on loyalty to himself and his big lie about the 2020 election. You know, often choosing people who are not good candidates and who may lose. So I think Republicans are sort of, you know, worried about that. That Trump seems to be choosing basically people based only on their loyalty to him, and he's not picking people that may win in the 2022. Mm.
But there's no serious challenge to his leadership of the party, is there?
No, I mean the only person I would point to as a potential next leader is Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. Mm-hmm. He is waging this really interesting campaign where he's on Fox News a lot. He's trolling the liberals a lot. He's done a lot of things. Both to enact conservative priorities in Florida, but also to sort of get people mad at him about coronavirus and other things. So in polls, you're starting to see him creep up, up and up. You know, I don't think he certainly hasn't said anything so far that he wants to take Trump on head on, but he may be hoping that if Trump decides not to run or if people get tired of Trump, that he's sort of anointing himself as the next guy. And he may eventually, that strategy may start to take some of Trump's oxygen away as people look to a new guy rather than this guy we've all heard about for 6 years.
Hmm. All right. And one more loose end. Can the Texas Rangers come to Washington, D.C. and just handcuff members of the legislature and take them back?
No. The Democrats have done this at least once before. They went to Oklahoma, I think, in 2010 or anyway, for a previous redistricting battle. It doesn't work that way. Basically, the governor has said that if they ever do come back to Texas, he will put them in the Capitol and not let them out. But as long as they're not in Texas, he can't get to them.
Okay. David Ferenthold, live from the Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.